to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamfro, naturopathic physician, professor at the University of Bridgeport, and your host for today. Dr. Kamai has the day off, and we're really excited to always bring you very cutting-edge information in alternative medicine, and we have a wonderful guest on, Dr. Woody Merrill. He's going to be talking about his book, The Source, Unleash Your Natural Energy, Power Up Your Health, and Feel 10 Years Younger, all things that we could do. But before that, we just wanted to thank everyone who came to our Chinatown Eco Tours for Cures Fun Shop, our tour through Chinatown. We had a wonderful time and look forward to doing a lot more events in the New York area. And you can always get more information on our website, naturalnurse.com. Check Dr. Kamai's website. That's the best place to get some information about our activities. But now, onwards with our very great guest and program. We're really excited to have Dr. Merrill on the program. And this is a really interesting book because, you know, many people feel tired and drained. They're always asking themselves that question. And it seems like just yesterday in the office at the University of Bridgeport, we had a gentleman who was a salesman. He would drive hundreds of miles every day. He'd eat on the run. He wouldn't exercise. He was losing feelings in his legs. His blood sugar was a little bit elevated. He had elevated blood lipids. He just was not feeling as well. It seemed like he was going through andropause or low testosterone syndrome and all kinds of things like that. You know, lack of energy and fatigue is often a doctor's nightmare, particularly if you're not a holistic doctor or integrative physician, because most doctors really aren't given a lot of the tools to do the differential diagnosis. They can diagnose things like whether you're anemic or virus or things like that, but they really don't. They lack the expertise to do functional medicine and look at, like, for instance, why your Krebs cycle is not working well. Is there any issues with your adrenals? Can we look at the ancient types of medicine like Chinese medicine and acupuncture and look for deficiencies of yin and yang and blockages of qi to the organs and things like that? And Dr. Merrill basically is an expert in these types of things. He practices acupuncture in New York, and he's also a very esteemed physician and head of integrative medicine various places in New York, and we're really excited to have him on there because we want to hear from his perspective in his book, The Source, basically how you can unleash your natural energy. Now, his book's broken down into different parts. Part one is transforming your energy and using the six ways to reclaim your vitality, so we'll let him tackle that. And then part two, he's got a great diet and cleanse type of thing with menus and recipes, which I always like, because when doctors tell you, Dr. Merrill, to do stuff, but they don't tell you how to do it, I always am suspect with that. So welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about...
I can't believe you started out the program by actually invoking the word Krebs cycle. That's, of course, one of my favorites, but not something that usually comes up in a conversation. So that's impressive.
Thank you very much, yeah. Well, you know, I've been practicing for a long time, too, and I'm a naturopathic doctor, and,
right.
And I teach a lot of the functional medicine classes at the University of Bridgeport. But, you know, let's just go back. You know, in my field, we actually go to school purposefully to study alternative medicine as a naturopath, but many doctors don't do that. They start out as a allopathic conventional medicine, and they kind of discover that they're not getting all the information to help the body with their conventional training, so that they end up, you know, kind of starting to be disillusioned, and they end up with, you know, learning and you know, getting other degrees, I guess, in acupuncture and Chinese medicine and board certifications and different things. Tell us your journey and how you started.
Well, I'm a little bit different because I started out in a what I call a good place. I was actually raised very holistically in California, lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. When I was growing up, they used to have the fishmonger and the vegetable produce man used to come by our homes. So we had a lot of fresh produce, and actually was raised with homeopathy when I was a child. So in the 60s, I was very into meditation and yoga and went to medical school as a real science lover to see if I could provide some interface between Asian, what were considered metaphysical practices, and Western science. And back in the 70s, there wasn't much to put the two together. There certainly is now. We'll talk about that, but at the time there wasn't. I dove into conventional medicine, and it wasn't really until I finished my residency training in medicine and I went into practice. As you said, I realized that I didn't have tools to help most of my patients who weren't ill with the diseases we learn in medical training, but they were in the gray area, kind of the worried well, people kind of almost working on getting sick, but not really focusing on what they needed to do to transform their health. And I think that you're right that, unfortunately, some of the tools that are so fundamentally needed, like nutrition, what to eat, literally is not, let alone stress management and exercise and the other fundamentals of health, are not taught in medical school still to this day. Nutrition is almost an afterthought in the very tiny part of the curriculum. So you're right. I, as many of my colleagues, took a journey back in the early 80s to find that what I could at the time that were evidence-based courses to help inform me, and of course now there are many of them that are available, especially through the Organization of Functional Medicine, to help guide me to work on really transforming my patients and bringing them back. And the book, the source that I wrote, and I'm writing one right now on detoxification, really looks at the six fundamentals of health that I've come to understand are the keys, which is stress management, proper nutrition, detoxification, proper rest, proper movement, and being connected. And really, people ask me which is the most important of those, and I say it's really the one you're not doing. So if you're looking either to be healthy or increase your energy, if you're eating great and exercising but you sleep 4 hours a night, well, you're just not going to get to where you need to. You really have to have a life in balance in order to achieve proper health and energy.
So hard. I mean, I'm even guilty of not looking, you know, not practicing some of those foundations because, you know, in the healing profession, we're here to serve other people, but maybe we get into it a little bit to heal ourselves. So I find that I'm kind of, you know, it's the end of the semester. It's finals week coming up next week. It's, you know, busy with the office and everything like that. There's not a lot of time. That seems to be the scarce resources, time poverty in this day and age.
Yeah, time management is really key. I think there's Stefan Rexhoffen, who founded the Omega Institute, wrote a great book on time management, and many people have. It's about putting your day in a proper perspective, and I think, for example, exercise is, we have to eat three or four times a day, so that one we can kind of try to organize, but we don't have to exercise, and I think that's one, it's not part of our day unless we make it part of our day. So, for example, people really have to structure that in. If you get to it when you get to it, you're not going to get to it. You have to structure it, and for example, myself, I Monday and Friday mornings, and Wednesday, I'm with a trainer, and it doesn't matter what comes up. It's sacrosanct time for me to do that because I am not good as a person or as a clinician unless I take care of myself. So those times don't ever get taken over by the other million things that we always can do, and then Wednesday I actually can manage to do it by myself.
So those are kind of like rocks. You know, like they always say, like the river of life will flow, and you'll either be swept up or you'll be like a rock in the middle of the river. And so exercise is something that you've, through good habits, have made that part of your rock, that and your spiritual practice, I'm sure, and good nutrition and things like that. So when you see patients that are exhausted and you start talking to them, what do you find is the most challenging things in their life? Give us a few examples.
Well, I think stress is by far and away the most challenging for most everyone. I think we're all, it's a very stressful time, really, and fatigue is an epidemic proportion, as is overweight and obesity. So many things have gone awry in our culture, and we're extremely stressed, and I think that you really have to manage. You have to go to your stress. There's so many things you have to do. We can get into talking about how to maybe make your diet much better without feeling too stressed by that, and also exercise. But you start with exercise, and I think that the studies are clear. You don't have to join a gym and exercise for an hour every day. The studies are very clear. If you exercise by taking a brisk walk for 30 minutes, even 2 15-minute segments, 3 to 4 days a week, you can increase your lifespan and decrease your risk of heart and vascular disease. And so this is a brisk walk. This is what we call a conversational tone, where you are just about to feel like you might be puffing and puffing, but you're not. And you push yourself a little bit. It could be just take a walk to work, park your car farther away, go out to lunch. I mean, these are not things where you have to do aerobics. Now, aerobics are better, so if you can exercise to the point where your heart rate is increased to at least above 120 for most people, that gives you added advantages. But the key thing is movement. And a really interesting study just came out this year that even people who exercise, if they were sedentary for 4 hours a day, which meant they didn't move from their chair, they had an increased risk of heart disease regardless of whether they did exercise or not. So it's about being active. For example, in my center, the Continuum Center for Health and Healing in New York, we have what are called human scale computers where you can actually move them up and down the wall, and the majority of the time our practitioners actually stand up while they're with their patient.
Well, that's a great idea. You burn a lot more calories standing while sitting. That's a wonderful concept that we could certainly even do at our university.
It's about movement. It's not about joining a gym. And certainly things like yoga are amazing because they not only exercise you but help with the stress as well, so does physical exercise. But I think that, you know, we're a very sedentary nation, movement can just consist of walking. It doesn't have to be a gym to get you started. Matter of fact, for people who have not exercised, what's interesting for energy is that they've shown that if you go from not exercising at all to doing aerobic exercise for 30 minutes three times a week, within a month you will double your energy capacity. These little energy factories in the cells called the mitochondria, they will actually double in number. You actually create energy by exercising more.
Yeah, that's very important to talk about, because most people, when they're drop-dead tired, they can't even fathom exercising, or sometimes exercising sets them back. Did you ever see that?
Well, if you start out in a bad place, if you start out very fatigued and kind of really physically beset almost with disease, and you overdo it, yes, it's going to set you back. And you know, anyone who stopped exercising for a few months and starts again can definitely be more achy or tired for the first couple sessions. So you have to pace yourself based on your age and your medical issues. But you'll always feel a little bit more tired. But what you after the first one or two times, you'll actually get energy from it. It's the same with meditating. You know, the most important time to do a stress reduction exercise is first thing in the morning. The highest incidence of heart attacks by 400% are first thing in the morning on awakening. So you need to start your day by, even if nothing else, sitting at the edge of your bed and taking a few deep breaths, ideally for 15 minutes, but at least for two or three. And you wake up and you think, there's no way I'm going to sit and close my eyes. I'll just fall asleep. But what's amazing is you actually get energy when you sit and actually do a relaxation exercise. I won't maybe use the word meditation if that's off-putting to people, but that's what it is. It actually gives you energy. You wake up very energized for having actually calmed your nervous system at the beginning of the day.
When people are starting to go back to the exercise, are there any supplements that you've actually seen to help them either repair their muscle faster or be less sore, or, you know, move the blood or help with circulation to remove lactic acid and to heal some of the micro trauma that happens in the muscles when you start using, like, for instance, shin splints? Like, I had a
patient that just started to walk, and they came in, they say, you know, Dr. Z, I have great sneakers and things like that, but I haven't walked so much that I have shin splints now, and I can't even flex my foot up there.
All right. So first of all, you should stretch, and stretching is best done after exercise. You can actually, if you start out stiff and you start stretching, you can actually make it worse. If you have to get warmed up a bit gently and then do exercise, and then even better during the exercise, stretch, and at the end of the exercise, stretch. But in terms of using supplements, you know, the foundation of health is basically food-based, and you should really get everything you need from food. But having said that, you know, people have various conditions and issues where there's no question that using some supplements can be helpful. There's no way, with the caveat that there's no way you can possibly get in the pill all the phytonutrients that nature has provided us naturally. But for example, for musculoskeletal trauma, for example, enzymes are really helpful thing. We think of enzymes as digesting food, and they're obviously really helpful for people with digestive issues. But if you take enzymes with food, they digest food. But if you take them in between meals, actually, enzymes are actually absorbed into the body, and they go to reduce inflammation. So enzymes taken, as I say, in between meals, and you know you have to be aware of the quality companies, Enzymedica, and some of the other companies that specialize in enzymes. Make ones that are specifically geared for different purposes, they can be very helpful. Another category of supplements that could be helpful are topicals. And I think that people know about, you know, using liniments and icy heat, but there are some homeopathic creams that are fantastic. Now, if the problem is deep inside the hip, putting it on your skin is not going to penetrate. But, for example, there's Tofersen or Traumil or Arnica gels that can sometimes be very helpful, particularly Tofersen, rubbed into the skin, getting to the tendons and some of the ligaments and muscles that are really beneficial. And then there are other nutrients, but honestly, if you begin to take things such as fish oil or curcumin or MSM or glucosamine, these things can be useful, but they really need a guidance of a physician, a naturopath, or a doctor, a nurse practitioner who's knowledgeable, because especially if you're taking medications, these things are biological agents, and they're not without, nothing you take orally is without possible side effects in some people. You know, peanuts kill people. So, I mean, grapefruit juice inhibits the metabolism of drugs. So you have to be, the more you take a concentrated form of anything, even if it's a nutrient, the more you have to rely on good guidance. And I would consider the internet, for the most part, not good guidance. There's way too much misinformation. I think that those states that are fortunate to have naturopaths, which unfortunately in New York it's not legal, or not that it's illegal, they just haven't licensure. But Connecticut and most of New England, you guys are lucky, because a naturopath, as I don't have to tell you, provides this kind of nutrition-based lifestyle medicine that doctors often struggle with. It's a great kind of synergistic the MD should know this stuff, but mostly they don't. And I think in states where you can find a naturopath, I'm going to give a little plug for your profession.
Thank you. That's appreciated. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of naturopaths.
Right.
But that, you know, in your book, you also talk a little bit about toxicity. And I think that has to be explained, because I get calls sometimes in my office and people are like, you do detox, I'm on morphine and I got to get off it. So I don't use the word detoxification sometimes when I advertise. I use depuration or some of the older terms, because detoxification has a connotation of either helping people get off of alcohol or morphine or drugs or opiates and things like that. What's your comment on that?
Or it's used by people without medical licensure, without any licensure,
yes, exactly,
or certification,
right,
to do quote unquote detox and colonics and things like that. So I think that there's no question that we're a very polluted society. I mean, we know with global warming, we know with pollution. The CDC nearly 10 years ago did a study that each of us has 153 at that time potentially toxic chemicals, even carcinogenic potential in each of us. And the studies by the Environmental Working Group, they looked at umbilical cord blood and babies in three cities, and 100% of them had residues of heavy metals, DDT, dioxin, 100% in babies. And so you actually, even in fetal life, are exposed to toxins. The line of the people who don't believe in toxins causing a problem, which clearly is industry, but even some scientists, is that they're present in our body at levels below the known toxic threshold. So, you know, but the question is, if you have 153 chemicals that are just below the toxic threshold, is there a synergy in a negative way of them kind of overwhelming our body's ability to clear them? Like when I do a blood test for mercury, normal's up to 10. Now, why shouldn't mercury be zero in the body, right?
Yeah.
It's because we can detoxify, but you get to the point where the detoxification mechanisms, which are quite exquisite in every cell, and especially the liver, can become overwhelmed with just too much exposure. And when that happens, these toxins are stored in our body, mainly in the fat cells, because most of them are fat-soluble, and they begin to wreak havoc. They poison the cell. They poison the mitochondria's ability to produce energy. They poison enzyme systems for the internal healing of the cells. They poison the cell's ability to make the chemicals that we need. And they also turn on pathways that actually even can lead to the point of producing a cancer, such as, you know, a lot of them are hormone disruptors that overstimulate the estrogen receptors. They kind of fit into these locks as a fake key to turn on a mechanism that isn't meant to be turned on very much, and they just constantly put it on overdrive. And so I think that which is why I'm writing the book right now. It was one of the six chapters in The Source, about things that deplete energy and health, but it's such a misused term, and it's so subject to kind of flimflammery that I wanted to provide a science evidence basis to the fact that yes, the problem of toxicity exists, and yes, there are things that we can do, a lot of which are lifestyle based, and we must address this. You've got to address it first by not letting any more toxins in, going organic as much as you can, using water filters, filter your air, but then also address the buildup that you already have in your system, and actually how to get rid of that.
So they know that these things are in, excuse me, people from the umbilical blood studies and the adipose studies. Now, here's a question. Why do some people hold on to these things? And why does the body in its wisdom, you know, we're supposed to be working with the healing power of the body. And, you know, the body in its wisdom makes decisions. There's a hierarchy of decisions it makes, being an intelligence, supreme intelligence. So why does the body store some of these things versus get rid of them? Is it just like, why do we throw garbage in our garage and our closets and then eventually have to spring clean?
All chemicals are detoxified through two phases in every cell in the body, especially the liver. In phase one, called cytochromes, there are specific cytochromes that are indicated for each class of drug. And for example, the ones that have to do with benzene and some heavy metals also have to do with coffee. So that if, you know, you can overload that one pathway by providing having too many of those substances, and then it never gets to even the first pass of detoxification, and the body can't deal with it, and it just has to put it somewhere, so it stores it in its usual storage site, which is the fat cells. The other problem is that if it makes it through that first phase, the second phase, which is called conjugation, you take these substances that have been gone through the first phase of detox, and they actually become almost worse. The body makes them almost into like free radicals, so that the second phase can kind of glom onto them easily and chelate them and make them water soluble for the most part, so they go out the kidneys. But if you don't provide the body with enough nutrition to provide those phase two chelators, then you will not be able to pull things out, and things will back up even in that kind of toxic intermediary state, and you're almost worse off than if you hadn't even made it through phase one. So you not only need to provide the nutrients for phase one, and not overload it by continuing to allow toxins into your system, but you need to provide the nutrition you need for phase two to actually finally chelate these substances, and so they can be dumped out the stool and, right, and the urine for the most part. And then nutritional lack is so pervasive, the lack of, you know, the minimum helping of fruits and vegetables we need, the minimum to stay even a day, is eight, and the typical American gets three, and for 30% of people, the 70% of their intake of fruits and vegetables consists of the top two on that list, which are French fries and ketchup. So I think that you know, we are a meat sweet society. That has produce and even the meats that are have quite a few pesticides and herbicides and hormones in them that provide a challenge for the body. If you combine that load of toxins with lack of nutrition, it's kind of a metabolic calamity for the body. Depending on your genetic predisposition, it can predispose toward either feeling poorly or actual disease.
So what are some user-friendly ways to get, more veggies in it for people that don't like veggies? Because we have people, unfortunately, that they've grown up and they really haven't eaten vegetables quite a bit. And I'm sure you have some good take-home things in your book there. I've seen that for people.
Well, one thing is just to remember when you're eating is, I want to start to say a couple things. One is chew. Most people don't chew. They throw chunks of undigested food that never gets fully digested. You need to be able to extract the nutrients from your food. And if you have trouble with digestion, again, things such as enzymes can help digestion. But something you can do that doesn't involve a lot of chewing is juicing. And we're in a phase right now, which is a wonderful phase, where, you know, these juice stores are popping up like, you know, basically yogurt stands, or Starbucks used to, Juice Press, Juice Generation, Blueprint Cleanse, Organic Avenue, even Starbucks is, although their juices are not yet organic, they're opening up Evolution juices. Juicing is fantastic. So if you take fruits and
vegetables. I remember that in Seattle about 30 years ago when I was out there, all the juice bars that were opening up, and I'd come back home, you know, I was in medical school then, naturopathic school. There'd be nothing here.
Right.
So it's nice to see that.
And, you know, all the Whole Foods carry them. A lot of the local gyms carry them. They're marketing like crazy. It's a huge exploding new area, which is fantastic. And most of them are organic and cold press. And what the thing is, what is great there, you get everything from the fruit and vegetable in the way these juices are made. They even keep the fiber in most of them. So what you're getting is you're getting all the nutrients and you're getting all the enzymes and the energy locked up in food with juicing, cold press. And so you can have a 12-ounce glass, and it could be a couple, two or three helpings of fruits and vegetables. And, you know, you can make it taste better by putting something in like some carrot juice or apple juice or beet juice. It's a little bit sweeter if the tartness of the you know, the greens is off-putting, because greens are the mainstay to have. But it's about a rainbow blend of different colors providing all the phytonutrients you need. So beside chewing more, having juice, and the great thing about juices is that they're raw. Now, some food you got to cook. I mean, you can't eat rice or beans unless you cook it. And some foods, such as cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, they're just, you have to chew like, you know, 50 times per bite if you're going to really digest it. So cooking is not all bad. I'm not a raw food fanatic, but the closer you get to raw food, the better you are, because of just, I want to just give two fascinating illustrations. One is that If you boil food, you begin to break down the vitamin C and B vitamins in them and destroy those. Right. If you cook food even at that's 212 degrees. If you cook food even above 140 degrees, you actually destroy the enzymes. And enzymes are so incredibly powerful for not only digestion but for healing. That is a big lack when you cook food. The other thing we've just come to understand in terms of energy, this is amazing, and even was new information for me this last month, is that the energy currency in the body is this molecule called ATP. The way that we work is that these little energy factories in the cells called mitochondria make this substance called ATP, and then the body can break it up and it releases energy when it needs energy. It turns out that we used to think every cell made its own ATP and it made what it needed, and sometimes it didn't make enough and you felt tired. But it turns out ATP actually circulates in the body. There are receptors for it in every cell, which means it's there to accept ATP from other cells. What's fascinating is that the intestine, the lining of the intestine has ATP receptors. So why does it have ATP receptors? Why is it ready to accept ATP? Because ATP is in food. Literally, there's energy locked up in food. And there's some preliminary research that for example, this is a bad example because I'm not telling people to go out and eat chicken, but we did one study where a typical chicken has 30 million ATP molecules in it. When you cook it, it goes down to 85,000.
Wow.
And the same thing with every fruit and vegetable, literally have ATP, they have these ATP in them. Actually, they haven't all been studied, so I can't say all. And that energy will be taken up by the intestines. Beside the enzymes, you also destroy ATP when you cook. So you take out some of the energy, you take out some of the enzymes, and you reduce some of the nutrition. But you get all of that when you juice. So I'm not saying you should live on juices, but having it as an adjunct to your diet would be a great way of adding in fruits and vegetables. And by the way, I said 8 helpings a day. It doesn't mean 8 cooked vegetables. Like a salad can be 3 helpings if you put tomatoes and cucumbers and celery on it. It's not like you have to have 8, you know, cooked vegetables. A glass of juice counts, an apple counts. So there's, you know, it's easier to get the minimum in that you need.
Right. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more because I have a bunch more questions to ask as we close in on the second segment. So stay tuned, folks, right here to Progressive Radio Network. And welcome back to this second segment of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm interviewing Dr. Woody Merrill. He's a medical doctor, integrative physician. He's based in Manhattan, and he's chairman of the Department of Integrative Medicine at Beth Israel Medical Center, Manhattan campus of Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He also teaches at Columbia, and he's a wonderful author of this book, The Source, Unleash Your Natural Energy, Power Up Your Health, and Feel 10 Years Younger. So, Dr. Woody, we want to talk a little bit about the gut flora, especially with this interesting new information that's just come with, that the balance of probiotics and dysbiotics may contribute to heart disease and so many other diseases. What's the microbiome and how important is it?
Oh my God, it's so powerful, it's so incredibly important, you know, that, and also obesity, there are specific strains of bacteria, Bacteroides being one of them, that actually have been proven to make you gain weight more easily. So it's incredible that. What's amazing is, I like to say, you're born 100% human and you die 90% bacterial. You have 10 times the number of bacterial DNA in your body by adulthood than you have human cells. It's unbelievable. There are over 1,000 species of bacteria on our skin and our orifices, and particularly in our gut where most of it resides.
So
and,
who's living in who?
Right? It really, it's a symbiotic relationship, and you need to have, obviously, most of these bacteria be healthy, beneficial ones, and not destructive ones that are sapping our health and energy, and particularly in this era of antibiotics and toxins, the gut has become seriously imbalanced, and a lot of current illnesses, the rise in autoimmune diseases and inflammatory bowel disease, such as Crohn's and colitis and asthma, is tied to the microbiome. And the beneficial ones are being rapidly, you know, taken out. This is the dirt theory of people who grow up in a healthy, like out in the country, where they're exposed to bacteria at an early age and not antibiotics, have a much lower incidence of asthma, allergies, immune system disorders than do people who grew up in cities with antibiotics. So I think that, you know, this is, it's hard because it begins as a child, but this is why probiotics can be very beneficial to people. Strains such as Acidophilus and Bifidophilus, and if you take Enterobacter Saccharomyces, can actually benefit not only the immune system, because you know close to 70% of all the immune system resides in the intestines. It can actually help set how you react to food. You can actually become much more reactive to foods if your gut flora is imbalanced. And it also obviously helps the digestion, because a significant amount of your digestion occurs lower down the intestines, especially if you have a poor digestive system. The bacteria do a lot of the work of digestion, and if you have mainly the pathological bacteria, it can produce a lot of gas, bloating, cramping, and even lead to an imbalance to things such as colitis and even Crohn's disease.
Not only that, it actually makes toxins, which I know you can pick up in certain functional medicines that you do in the office, like the organic acid analysis actually picks up byproducts of Clostridia and other species of what we call dysbiotes, which then can contribute to disease. If you have Clostridia growing in you, or whether it's C. diff or other species, that can lead even to behavioral disorders and affect the dopaminergic aspects of the brain. So it's like, it's these ancient concepts. I know you practice Chinese medicine, and they used to say that the phlegm, that, and I'm not talking about the phlegm that you hack up your lungs, but the phlegm from the undigested food will leave the intestine and create this, what the Chinese would say, an evil mist,
yep,
which will then block the orifices, block the circulation, block the brain. Now that sounds like a lot of, you know, kind of mystical things, but this is what the science is actually proving, that these 5,000-year-old concepts are true.
Yeah, very much so. I think we talk of it now. Even the term leaky gut was considered kind of hooey 10 years ago. But I think what they're realizing now is that when you have too many toxins and you're not digesting food well, and when these bacteria that are there actually, they produce endotoxins. So the best example of that is like when you get salmonella from a bad chicken or you get E. coli from a bad hamburger, you get sick because they produce toxins. They're called endotoxins. And a lot of bacteria, beside those two bad guys, there are over 180 species of salmonella in your gut. A lot of those toxins are created, and they actually punch holes in the protective wall of your intestines and allow things to leak into your system. And as you mentioned, can go to your brain. For example, celiacs, another good example. Here's a chemical sensitivity that actually can punch a hole in your gut and can actually lead to changes in the brain and brain function and headaches. And this is proven in the neurologic literature. So
yeah,
leaky gut, I think, is increasingly being looked at as a big factor in how people express problems and symptoms and even disease itself.
And you do the 4R program, which was a nice mnemonic that Dr. Bland developed many, many moons ago, where we rid the body of the toxic foods and the toxic bacteria, and we, you know, rekindle the digestive. That's actually, I added that one because I didn't like the replace, because it was confusing. Is it replace the bacteria and then is repopulate? So I like the idea rekindle, because
yeah,
that's what the Ayurvedic doctors would always say, rekindle the digestive fire. Then we repair the gut and we repopulate. Talk about those 4 R's.
Well, you want to remove, first of all, so you want to remove any toxins and influences that are producing a strain on the body and the digestive system. And you want to replace them with healthier foods. Into the gut with really healthy foods. And you may need to, in terms of repair, you need to take some substances that are actually going to begin to repair some of the damage that's been done from eating poorly or taking toxins into the system. Examples of this are, some people may need, again, enzymes if their digestive system has been very sluggish. They definitely usually need probiotics to help to heal and to kind of reduce the amount of the pathological bacteria and bring up the healthy bacteria in the body. And that process of helping to repair the gut and rejuvenating it. I like the R word of rejuvenate, by flooding it with healthy nutrients after you've kind of removed the bad guys and added in some of the nutrients you need to help it repair. Ultimately, you shouldn't need to spend the rest of your life taking supplements. I mean, food should be your medicine, but in that interim period, there are certainly supplements from a functional perspective that can help repair the damage that's been done, rejuvenate the digestive system, so you can actually begin to use food as medicine in a way that's clean and healthy, rather than half the time spent struggling against the food from the toxins and against your own internal altered immunity and flora and fauna.
Until, unfortunately, you get exposed to antibiotics again, then you may have to revisit the four R's again. You mentioned that there's a lot of antibiotic residues in our food and hormones and sugars. I know on your blog site, iwellville.com, you talk about the amount of sugar found in food. All that has to influence the flora, does it not?
Yes, I have to give credit to my wife, who's a health journalist for iWellville. That's
a
wonderful
great.
Site.
I loved it, looking at that.
Yeah, it's very, and also the website, that's a fantastic website for the consumer of kind of the cutting edge stories. And also at my center, the healthandhealingny.org, for medical professionals with a lot of the evidence-based literature. You know, sugar, it turns out, is really almost the worst toxin, perhaps the worst toxin than it's ercotide. The saturated fats, as much as animal fats are a toxin, sugar actually is found to perhaps, with raising insulin, be almost a worse trigger in our system. And the amount of sugar we take in is enormous. And the type of sugar we take in is not just the sucrose and glucose, but the fructose that we're taking in has become astronomical. And this is not something that we're meant to have in large doses. Normally, fructose is just present in two or three pieces of fruit we might eat a day, and that's it. Fructose does not raise insulin, but it does even worse things. It primarily goes to the liver, where it's turned into fat and actually impairs the liver function and stores up as fat in the body. So it turns out it may be worse in terms of toxicity and inflammation than the typical table sugar. So no sugar is good. We've got to get back to having whole grains and not having refined carbohydrates and not having things sweetened with sugar or with fats for that matter. And I think in cooking, you can replace a lot of these things with flavor. What a concept, right? And you could. This is where herbs and spices. I'm a huge fan of herbs and spices because they add so much flavor. And every herb and spice you take in, I can't say enough about the healing properties of herbs and spices. They all have anti-inflammatory activity. Many of them are actually germicidal. They actually help to kill. Mm-hmm. They actually help to kill germs. They help to reset the immune system, some of them. They're fantastic, and there's really no excuse anymore for giving into the meat sweet part of our diet when you have such much more access to organic dairy, and not that eggs are great, but also are much more clean sources of chicken if you must, and being aware of healthy fish and more organic fruits and vegetables. I think that people need to be aware that it's more expensive sometimes organic, and in terms of fruits and vegetables, if you pick those ones with thick rinds, such as the citrus, and avocados and other ones, bananas and tropical fruits, that there's most of the pesticides are sprayed from the outside. And if you have some of them are not too bad to have that are non-organic, particularly with thick skin. So, you know, the industry has been, they've created a worse problem for us in that, for example, corn, what they do now is they actually encase the corn kernel when they put it in the ground to grow it with pesticides. It actually then goes up through the plant into the corn, so they don't actually have to spray as much from the outside. So you just can't get rid of it no matter whether you rinse it or it has a husk or not, some of these fruits and vegetables.
So, you know, this is the reason why, you know, eating organic is very critical, though, you know, people have to be aware of what's really certified organic and, you know, there's a whole other discussion that we can have for an hour about that whole thing. But, you know, generally I like to tell people, and I'm sure you agree, kind of eat stuff in the periphery of the grocery store. Don't go through the middle.
Totally, where it's all processed. And I think that any, the old adage, anything that has more than five ingredients in it or that it has an ingredient your grandmother wouldn't understand, don't do it.
Okay, that's a good piece of advice.
And, you know, or bad organic. Again, we want to reduce our toxic load. But if someone is not eating fruits and vegetables, I'd rather them at least have, particularly in season now, locally grown, sustainably grown produce that isn't organic. It's better than not having any. And so try to be organic as much as you can, but the key is to increase the amount of produce in your life, and we need to go much more to a plant-based diet, not only for nutrition, but for enzymes, for helping our system, and for the phytonutrients that we can only get in whole foods you can never get in a capsule.
Like the old-timers used to say, the salad is the meal. I don't mean just raw salad. I mean lots of vegetables and things.
Yes.
Juices. And lastly, let's, in the last 6 minutes of the program here, let's just talk a little bit about genes and epigenetics.
Oh, I love people, it. Thank you.
Yeah. People say that, you know, you are doomed to express the diseases that your parents and aunts and great aunts and uncles have. We look at them and say, oh, my God, everyone had diabetes in the family. I'm bound to get it. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, this is fantastic. The world of epigenetics, and for the listeners out there, the epigene, you know, the gene is the chromosome that has DNA, and that we're born with the DNA that instructs our body what to do. There's a region outside the gene that protects, has always been felt to be mainly a protector of the gene, called the epigene. Epi means around. And so it has these various substances, histones and other things, that actually protect the gene from damage. But it turns out that this epigene is much more active than we thought. It turns out that you can look at the DNA gene as the hardware and the epigene as the software. The actual environment and our lifestyle tell the epigene what to do, and it actually tells the gene what to do. It turns out that between 70 and 90% of disease expression that comes from our genes is managed by the epigene. You can literally change the way you're hardwired, your genes express themselves. You could turn good ones on and turn bad ones off, or vice versa, based on from the environment, which means toxins gets into the epigene, and what you put into it that's beneficial, particularly in terms of phytonutrients and reducing the kind of internally produced chemicals that are a result of stress and lack of sleep and lack of exercise.
Yeah.
And you literally can change your genetic destiny up to, the recent estimates are at least 70%.
So if you notice that sometimes it's not just the genes that runs in families, but it's habits that run in families, you know, big gap. I mean, my family, they're just terrible as far as when we go to a family gathering, there's a gazillion sweets there. And I keep telling my parents and aunts and uncles, why are you doing this stuff, blah, blah, blah. And I always bring some alternative snacks for me and my family and whatnot. But still, it's like, you know, you got the genes there, but you also have the habits that are taught since you're a young kid. Now, you were lucky you grew up in a healthy family. I had to actually be like a rebel.
So I think that what's interesting is that the epigene, the changes you make in the epigene are actually heritable. That means they're actually inherited. You actually give them to your progeny. They inherit the changes you make to the epigene, good and bad. So you can actually change the software of how your genes work.
Right.
That could be inherited in future generations. So it's beyond what happens to you. It's actually what happens to your children, to undo a lot of the damage that occurs to us beginning in fetal life. And one thing you touched on something I just think is kind of an aside here that I love telling people is you got to carry around often your own food. So, for example, carry healthy snacks. Carry nuts or trail mix for around with you, for example. Or not that I love them, but there are even some reasonably healthy, you know, bars out there you could have. And you, if you're going to somebody's house and you know they serve crappy food, or you're going to a cocktail reception, you know it's going to be all junk, or you're working on a set if you're a model and actor, take your own healthy snacks with you and eat before you get there something yeah. healthy. So when you're not starving. Same thing going out to a restaurant. Don't go to a restaurant hungry if you're trying to control your food intake, for God's sakes. Eat something, like at least an apple or half a yogurt or nuts before you go, so you don't get there and you just start polishing
eating the bread. Eating the
yeah.
bread and all that stuff that
yes.
they serve, you know. Very good advice. I think that's the key, is making these small habits. But people, and in the final things, you know, we look at, you know, the mind and the power of behavior and the spirit, and all that plays a big role. The mental, the shen, what the Chinese say, your
yes.
shen or your spirit. Talk a little bit about that and end the program with that kind of stuff.
Ending with what I think really is the most powerful. I mean, stress management is probably at the top of the heap. But you need to do everything in terms of lifestyle. But being connected, having particularly a spiritual connection, and even for the atheists in the crowd, being connected to nature, to your loved ones, to your family, to your friends, to a hobby, to an activity, we're disconnected in our society. We don't have the old world culture with a close family unit. We're disparate, and I think we need to have connections, and you find what that connection is for yourself. If you happen to be spiritual, religious, there it's the most powerful healing tool. I'm spiritual, so I feel strong that spirituality, prayer, and other forms of expression and connection are the most powerful healing tools you can have. And there's actually dozens of studies that show that the more the religiosity, actually the more religious you are, or the more spiritual, the better your health.
It could be drumming. I mean, you know, I know it could be drumming, or it could
yes.
be whatever, reverence to nature. So
yes,
yeah,
having a pet.
Exactly.
Pets are very therapeutic.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Tell us about how we can get in touch with you, Dr. Merrill. Appreciate all your words of wisdom here.
Well, thank you. I think that the website, iwellville.com, is great. Through my center, you can access the email and the website. It's called www.healthandhealing, all written out, healthandhealingny.org. Is the website, and that's how they can reach me. And so I think it's the best evidence-based guide for reliable information in this field of integrative medicine, combining complementary with conventional. It's about 1,000 pages of information with a lot of clinical studies.
Great. Hey, thanks a lot, and stay healthy, and we really appreciate your input there.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a good day. Stay
you
healthy.
Too.
Okay, and that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network for wonderful information to keep you listener-driven radio station, where you get cutting-edge information on many aspects of natural living. So until such time, stay healthy, folks. This is Dr. Z signing out. Bye-bye.